Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Yahoo Fantasy Baseball Podcast. I am Scott Pianowski. It is Monday, June 22nd, and I am really looking forward to today's show. I'll say up front, it's not going to be a fantasy-centric show. We're not going to tell you who the best closers are in the American League West or anything like that, but we are going to talk baseball with a damn good baseball writer. Hannah Kaiser has been with Yahoo for a couple of years, and she's got a lot of interesting credits. She's covered sports and food for Major League Baseball, Deadspin, Vice. She lives in New York. I'm reading this right off her bio. She lives in New York, growing up outside of Philly and getting an ancient history degree from the University of Pennsylvania that almost never comes up in her current line of work. You're not trying hard enough, Hannah. She thinks bandwagoning is good, long relief is underrated, and hot dogs are an embarrassment to the game of baseball. You can follow Hannah on Twitter, Hannah R. Kaiser, K-E-Y-S-E-R, and on Instagram, Clever W. Panache. Hello, Hannah Kaiser.
Hello. I actually have used my ancient history degree more during this pandemic than I ever did before. I interviewed some historians who specialize in the collapse of civilizations for a story that's unrelated to baseball a few weeks ago about whether or not we're living through the end of the civilization as we know it.
Well, that's awesome. You know, the true writers, you know, we're sports writers, but I consider you a writer. Like, I consider Andy Behrens a writer. I mean, the guy's written novels, for crying out loud. And you should be able to write about anything, you know? You should be able to write about personalities or write about television or write about music or just whatever interests you. And when I was in college, I went to a journalism symposium, and I went to this one thing on sports journalism, and the guy gave a great speech. I wish I could remember his name or where he was from. I don't remember any of that. But I remember how he talked about how important it was to be well-rounded. And, you know, if you want to be a sports writer, just don't read Sports Illustrated. Just don't watch ESPN. But you have to know things about the world and be curious and you know, just be exposed to different things. And I think that makes a good writer. And I think that's a big reason why we're finding out in 2020 who really has, I think, journalism chops. And when I look at your work, the fact that you have a very wide background, I think that speaks to why you've done a really good job covering the strangest year of our lives.
Oh, well, thank you. I went to University of Pennsylvania, and the reason I got an ancient history degree is because Penn does not have a journalism degree, for the specific reason that they wanted people to learn about other subjects. So I have a journalism minor. You could get a journalism minor. We have fantastic journalism classes, incredible journalism professors, being so close to New York and being a big city. And they have this like great writing program, but they specifically make everyone who studies journalism study something else as well, under the logic that, you know, being able to understand the world and have some sort of subject matter in your background is as important to journalism as being able to write and cite sources. So yeah, I think that's proven true.
Totally well said. I went to a liberal arts college. I went to Providence College. They don't have journalism, but you know what you could do is, if you wanted to do stuff on the paper and you really want, it's not like I went to Syracuse and had to beat out 500 other people. At Providence, you pretty much just signed up for the paper, and if you're any good at it, you got promoted immediately. And so that was my journalism degree. I ended up starting with, you know, some newspapers gave me opportunities. I was at the Providence Journal by the end of my college, and things worked out that way. I miss writing for newspapers, actually, but the internet's been great. No complaints there. So I spent this weekend thinking about this podcast. I spent this weekend playing a lot of golf. I played golf on Saturday. I went to the driving range on Sunday. I watched some of the tournament at Harbortown won by Webb Simpson, and then I spent most of last night researching a golf watch that I can't really afford or justify, but I want to know everything about it anyway. And I asked myself, why do I love golf so much? I mean, I'm okay at it. I'm not great at it. I'll never be that great at it. It is a fun thing to do with my friends and all that, but it kind of hit me that I have an obsession with fixing things. I'm not really good at fixing things either, but every once in a while I fix something. I fixed our air conditioner once, and I lived on a high for that for the rest of the summer. And so I was thinking about that, about fixing things. And then I wanted to do some research on you for this show. And I fell into a lovely Anything But Sports or Just Not Sports podcast that you did last year that was all about Sex and the City. And really, I wish I could remember who did that pod. If you know his name, you can tell me it. But so I was thinking, you know, how can I tie in golf and my weekend and Sex and the City with baseball? And it comes down to Sex and the City. So much of it is about, is this relationship fixable? Is this person dateable? Should Carrie be dating Berger, just giving up because, you know, he just, there's no long-term potential here. And I just started thinking about baseball. I'm in a long-term relationship with baseball. I've loved baseball my whole life. I grew up with baseball cards. As I got older, I started playing fantasy. I've written about it. I've covered it as a straight journalist. I've covered it from the fantasy angle. And right now, look, I mean, look, there's a pandemic going on, and a lot of people aren't healthy, and we don't know how safe it is to play baseball. And I don't want to lose that in the gravity of the moment here. But when I see the standoff between the players and the owners and all that, and I see the owners are negotiating in bad faith, and sometimes I get mad at the owners, but sometimes I just get mad in general. And then I think, why am I even mad? Maybe I shouldn't even think about it. So is baseball dateable? Is this a relationship I should get out of? Is baseball fixable? That's kind of what I was thinking about this morning, and I want you to bring some clarity to those things.
Oh, geez, I wish I knew. I think I was explaining to a friend yesterday who was sort of asking me about the labor stuff, and the person had a really fair question. This friend I was explaining it to was sort of like, so then it's no one representing the sport in these negotiations? Because they had read, I did this piece on how league employees are sort of just as frustrated with these negotiations as all the fans. And so this person like understands baseball, and they were like, you know, I understand that Rob Manfred represents the owners and that Tony Clark and Bruce Meyer represent the players. And they were like, so then when people talk about the league, what are they talking about? And I was like, that's a good point. Unfortunately, there is sort of no one representing baseball. There's no one actually sort of representing the league in these negotiations. The owners are what we're actually talking about when we talk about the league. And that can make baseball feel very undateable or very not worth your time during these labor negotiations. And I think it is helpful for me to understand that these labor negotiations are in some ways going the way that they are supposed to, that labor negotiations are not that only when we talk about sports do we feel like labor negotiations are what determines like the viability of the sport, that it really is. It is a negotiation between an employer and a group of employees, and those are inherently antagonistic and inherently economic based, and you know that the only compromise that can be reached is a matter of a balance of power and all of that. And that can feel really disillusioning. And I've written about this a lot and about the sort of cynicism of following labor strife. But I think you kind of have to love baseball beyond the owners and beyond even the players, which I feel bad saying because the players are the sport and I'm very pro labor and pro worker or whatever. I'm not sure if I'm making any sense. I guess what I'm saying is that it's like right now it feels like, is baseball flawed? And it's like, no, because baseball doesn't really have a seat at the table right now. Like what we're watching play out is a fight between an employer who has sort of run rampant over a group of employees for many CBA negotiations in a row, and now the players are trying to win back some level of recourse and some level of sort of agency and ownership over the game. But that is not, and it feels unfortunate because it doesn't feel like anyone has the best interest of the game at heart, and the truth is they don't, and that's fine. I think we just sort of have to accept that. We have to be like, what's happening right now is a labor negotiation, and it's very interesting and it's very impactful on the sport itself, but you can love the sport and be frustrated by the lawyers who are arguing right now. And I think that that's okay.
You know, it's funny. When I was a kid, I didn't understand what a commissioner was in the sense that I thought the commissioner, when I was like 11, I thought the baseball commissioner was just an impartial person who presided over the sport with equal agency for both sides. And it's not. The owners have all the power over the commissioner, and the moment that the commissioner doesn't serve their purposes, they will get rid of the commissioner. And that's, you know, history tells us that. Roger Goodell, his job as the NFL commissioner is to stand in front of everybody and get tomatoes hurled at him to push forward the agenda, what the owners want. It would be nice if he stood for both sides, but that's not really what the position is. And I asked, I think it was Joe Sheehan, who's one of the finest baseball writers we have, and he's been on this show before. I asked him, could someday they just have a commissioner who's just in the middle, who doesn't necessarily report to the owners, but he's reports to both sides, and they both have to sign off on him? And we didn't get into it, but he said he didn't really think it was practical. That's my 11-year-old solution to this, is that I wish we could get to mediation someday, or wish we could get to a commissioner that theoretically had 50% player interest and 50% owner interest. I think that would be good for the game. I don't know if there's a reason why we can't do that someday. It's obviously not going to happen today, but that's my 11-year-old solution.
I mean, I think plenty of people feel that way far beyond 11. People have people who are frustrated with what's happening have a tendency to lash out. And the common refrain in baseball, and I'm sure this is true in all sports, I'm sure people say this about Goodell and about Adam Silver, people will say, does Rob Manfred even like baseball? And look, I'm sure Rob Manfred loves baseball. The dude dedicated his job, his entire life to it, his entire career. And I'm sure it's not an easy job. And I'm sure he works very long hours. And I'm sure he wouldn't do it if he doesn't care about baseball. So it's not that Rob Manfred hates baseball. He didn't like scheme his way into this job to ruin the game from the inside. But you're right. It's just that he doesn't work for baseball. He works for 30 billionaires who are looking to turn a profit by owning baseball teams. And I think part of what I try to emphasize when I cover labor as it relates to the game is this idea that like acrimony is built into the system, that the way labor relations are supposed to work, like the way that every office place should unionize and the reason that the labor movement in media is so important and all of that is because it's supposed to be a balance of power, and it's supposed to be sort of an equal balance of power such that the way that the middle ground is served and the way that the interests of the game are served is by having to find a plan that works for both. And I think that part of what we're seeing right now is like just the unusual circumstances and the way that that's exerting influence over the negotiations. I think sort of like the lack of a deadline and also just the historic imbalance of power. The fact that it does feel like the union is sort of trying to make up for lost time and trying to recoup losses that they suffered in 2016. But I mean, to anyone who's like especially disillusioned, because I understand this has been like such a disillusioning time in baseball, maybe more so even than other sports, I would say that like, this is what labor looks like. This is what labor relations look like. I mean, the fact that the two sides are furious with each other because it feels like they've made equally strong, legally sound moves, that's unfortunately how it has to work. That like, it feels like we're getting a peek at how craven both sides can be, but that's, I think, My optimistic take on all of this and the reason why I'm able to like think that I will emerge from this loving baseball just as much is to simply have an understanding that like the ownership side has always been incredibly powerful. It is a multi-billion dollar industry that can afford the best lawyers and sort of the most legally strategic ploys at the negotiating table. And now the players are fighting back with equal force. And what we're seeing is two equally, maybe not quite equally, but hopefully more equal sides trying to get their due. And trying to get their due is what they are supposed to be doing right now. So hopefully the game is able to survive it. And I think it will, but that, yeah, labor stuff is not always pleasant.
I mean, negotiation on some level in this type of thing is going to be ownership parks itself with an offer that is unreasonable, is meant to be rejected. And then the players union will put forth an offer that they expect to be rejected. And then there's a tug of war going on and you slowly but surely get to some point in the middle, you know? Right. I think that's why I've always sucked at negotiations. I don't have the gall to go to Yahoo and say, hey, I want $3 million next year. I'm walking, right. You know?
The part that I think they sort of both sides are culpable for, although I try not to say both sides because it's the owner's fault. But the part that I do think both sides are culpable for is that they are treating this like a proxy CBA negotiation for what's to come in 2021, when clearly we're dealing with extenuating circumstances and a very sort of volatile situation. And even though there isn't a third party who's forcing them to mediate, it would be useful if they decided to mediate anyway, simply because they do have this common enemy in the virus and in trying to get a season in at all. And so I think that the sort of the actual tenor of the negotiations and the fact that it feels like they're so far apart and the fact that it feels like both sides are just talking about money, that's all to be expected. What is frustrating is the feeling that they're waging a proxy war a year and a half ahead of time, as opposed to dealing with what is in fact a very pressing problem in the virus and in the pandemic.
I'm going to ask you a loaded question, and I want you to try to answer it as concisely as you can, even though it's unfair for me to ask you that. Do you think we'll have a baseball season, and do you think we should have a baseball season?
Ooh, such a loaded question. I think we will start a baseball season. I think we will at the very least start a baseball season. I think the momentum and the pressure and that for as much as it does feel like both sides are willing to throw it all away, that they're not really. The thing I, this is not concise, but I'll wrap it up quickly. I'm always, whenever it seems like, whenever either side makes an offer, I always approach it with the mindset of like, these people are smart. They are good at what they do. And so there's a reason behind what they are doing. And because they are smart and because they are good at what they do, they will reach some sort of not middle ground, but some sort of mutually disagreeable version of a season that they're willing to put on.
And I don't want to be cynical here, but there's a lot of money in the middle of this, table.
Right, exactly. Yes, exactly. Right. Like they will figure out a way to plan for a baseball season, if nothing else, because they're not actually stupider than every person on Twitter who's sort of like, is baseball willing to throw this all away? They're not stupider than those people. So they will figure out a way to plan a season. There will be an opening day. There will be something on the calendar that says opening day. Now, what we saw last week with, I think, up to 40 players at different facilities testing positive for the virus at this point, is that I really, really think that the point at which it could come undone is like literally everyone reporting to camp. And so I know that they will set a schedule. I don't know that they will even play one game. Like, I am concerned that the point at which this will fall apart is the point at which everyone reports to camp and they realize that way more people have tested positive than they were counting on. And that, like, 20% of the league is going to have to quarantine. Not that much, but you know what I mean? Like, I think that the riskiest part actually is the part at which everyone shows up to spring training 2.0 and we find out exactly how many guys have gotten sick in the interim. And I don't know what's going to happen then. That's the part that seems really risky to me.
Yeah, it's really scary. I mean, I think everybody would understand if they just said, look, we don't know where we are health-wise. We can't guarantee that this can be safe. This can be morally acceptable. Maybe we just, I mean, I almost feel like 2020 is just going to be a punt in a lot of ways. And maybe we just have to just, but again, there's all this money in the middle and the players, you can own a team for your whole life. You can only be a player for a certain amount of time. Yeah. You have a window. What happens to a player like Mookie Betts, who was in a contract year? What happens to service time? There's so many different things to complicate. But I want to mention really quickly about Manfred. I kind of bristle when people make him the person that they hold accountable and they throw the tomatoes at, because if there's one person in America who desperately wants the baseball season to be saved, if it's not like a 9-year-old in Toms River, New Jersey, it's Rob Manfred. I mean, he wants nothing more than to get this solved, because if he doesn't, it's going to be his legacy in his head. He's going to be he's going to be seen as the fall guy, whether it's not or not, it's actually his fault. By the way, I want to add a little levity here, because I feel like this is a very deep conversation and a little bit depressing. I want you guys to know that Hannah is wearing a green New York Yankee Alex Rodriguez shirt as we tape this. And also that apparently A-Rod and J-Lo still want to buy the New York Mets. So we got those things.
Yeah, for some reason, nice. The Yankees are buying up the NL East. This has been this is a weird. I'm not a Yankees fan. I just love merch. I love merch.
So do I.
I'm like a total sucker for merch. And I particularly love like weird vintage finds. This is like a shameless, not even like a plug, but like, your people listen to your podcast. You have a very popular podcast.
Oh, yeah.
I would love for people to send me pictures, links, anything. I'm like, this is from the Brooklyn Flea. I go into vintage stores wherever I go. I have like a I have an obsessive collection with weird old vintage baseball merch. So show me your weird old vintage baseball merch if you have.
Love that stuff. We need all that stuff. There used to be a great website. And I guess it's just been replaced by Twitter and Instagram and everything. But there used to be an old website called Straight Cash Homie, which just the greatest name anyway. But it used to be just people taking photos of anybody in a jersey of a random player. Whether you don't remember the guy on the team, or it was just like the 25th guy on the roster, or some fifth receiver, punt returner, whatever, just totally random dude, you know, name on a sweater. And there were some great photos of guys in these jerseys, and the people who wrote for it and wrote the comments on it were really punchy and funny. And yeah, we need that stuff. By the way, you talked about merch and everything. Tell everybody about this whole bandwagon thing, about one of your brands at Yahoo, and just what that's all about.
So when there is baseball, I have a show. I have a video series that we do. It's called The Bandwagon. And the premise of the show is that I am, in fact, a genuine, at my heart, shameless bandwagoner. the origin story of my bandwagoning is that I was a Phillies fan my whole life. I'm from Philly, from the Philly area. And in 2012, I decided to be a San Francisco Giants fan, because I just loved Tim Lincecum so much. And I, like, hook, line, and sinker for the Giants. Like, asked my parents to get me plane tickets to San Francisco for my birthday. I had never been to a Giants game. And, like, I own a Tim Lincecum jersey now. And my sister came with me to the game, and we got the panda hat and everything. And they won the World Series that year. And I love that. And I think, When I got the job at Yahoo, and when I became a more serious, you know, national baseball writer, I thought a lot about this idea that how do you balance fandom with objectivity and with sort of being able to cover the game and being able to report on the more serious aspects, like things like labor. And I landed on that, like, actually being open to bandwagoning and having that kind of spirit was the correct way to do it, or at least the correct way for me to do it, was to sort of accept that, like, there are certain harsh realities of the game, and it's a business, and covering the labor stuff and that sort of thing, and everything that goes along with that. But that, like, allowing yourself to feel unbelievably excited in a fan-like way for whoever is exciting, that, like, that actually having the professional obligation to go see all these teams in person and all these ballparks and meet all these players, that, like, I wanted to feel like the way that you feel about the team that you love, that you're a fan of, I wanted to feel that way about all these teams as it came up and as it pertains to what I'm writing about or whatever's happening in the game. So last year we did a great video series. I'm, like, literally way too obsessed with it. It's, like, not cool. It's my own video series, and I still rewatch it, called The Bandwagon, where every week we talked about why one particular team was the team I was rooting for that week, along with a bunch of other things. And when baseball figures out how to come back, so will the show.
It's awesome that you rewatch your show, because I'm like always afraid to look at anything I've done. I'm afraid it's going to make me want to light myself on fire. But and sometimes I will reread something I wrote and think, oh, that's actually pretty good. I'm pleasantly surprised. But you know, we should go where the fun stories are, you know. And we don't know, you know, in the mid '90s, nobody knew Hideo Nomo was going to be as fun as he was, or, you know, Ichiro in 2001, or, you know, there'll be rookies who come up who maybe don't have pedigree and end up playing great, or somebody gets hurt, somebody else gets an opportunity. You know, maybe this was going to be a really fun year for the Pittsburgh Pirates or the Marlins, or, you know, maybe Casey Mize was going to come up and throw a no-hitter for the Tigers or something. I mean, we don't know. The future is unwritten, and I see nothing wrong with just going to whatever ends up being the fun story.
Even in this sort of downtime, there was the Royals were the rare team that didn't release any minor leaguers and promised to keep paying them all through the end of the season. And in fact, their owner, oh my God, Dustin Morse, that's his name? No, why am I? That's not correct. Royals owner.
That's Hannah doing a Yahoo search, by the way.
Whatever. Anyway, he had some great comments about it. And I was like, yeah, great. My immediate reaction was like, bandwagon the Royals. Like, it's like, it is sort of fun to allow yourself to be like, some things are bad, but that thing is great. That part thing over there is good. Like, this team is doing it right. And particularly, right, like, you know, it was like everything, or now I'm blanking out, was it whatever, whichever team it was. Covering a sport can make you feel like the story is always to point out what's wrong, and it is, but forcing yourself to also point out what's right is kind of nice. It's nice to sort of be like, this team is doing a good thing, and or this player is really fun, or like, it's nice.
And also, things can be fun in a bad way. I mean, you know, I'll rewatch Top Gun. I have no delusion of Top Gun being a great movie, but I think it's rewatchable. I think Dirty Dancing is very rewatchable. It's, again, it's not one of the best 100 movies, but it's, you know, it's got some funny quotes in it. It's got some poignancy to it. It's got Patrick Swayze in it, who, you know, had an interesting career. Jerry Orbach. Anyway, I don't know why I love Dirty Dancing, but I do.
I love Dirty Dancing.
Yeah, I love Dirty Dancing. I figured you probably would, because you just, I don't know.
I saw a great Father's Day tweet that was like, I'm going to like steal somebody's joke off Twitter, but it was like, it was like from baby's father's point of view, Dirty Dancing is just a movie about how he's like a hardworking cardiologist who just wanted to go on vacation, and now he knows far too much about his daughter's sex life. And I was like, yeah, poor guy. He's like, he's like a hardworking doctor in the city, and he's like, just give me 2 weeks to play golf and look at a lake.
Right, right. Yeah, he just wants to play canasta. I love that the quotes from Dirty Dancing live on. I mean, you know, when I'm wrong, I say I'm wrong. You know, nobody puts baby in a corner. It's a wonderfully somewhat dated but still fun movie that, and I don't know, let's talk about rewatchable things. Again, I listened to that podcast where you have gone through Sex and the City like a Zapruder tape, and yeah. I've seen about maybe a third of the show. The irony was that when it was on, I liked it more than my girlfriend did, so I think I might have even gotten her some DVDs for Sex and the City for Christmas one year, and she, you know, she liked the show okay, but she didn't love it. I've rewatched Mad Men and The Sopranos so many times, like I'm getting paid to be on staff or something, because I just love, again, going back to golf, I just love taking things apart and putting them back together again. And I think it's also fascinating that you were saying, I think Sex and the City, the fourth season, was the best, which I think is also the best Sopranos season. I think sometimes it takes a while for a show to figure out what it's going to be and where they want character arcs to go, or even if they want to have character arcs, if they want to have those slow burns and those nuanced plot lines. What is it about rewatching things? I mean, now we're at a time where there's the great thing about sports is you have to watch them in real time. You can't tape the third game of the World Series and watch it on Tuesday. You know, you have to watch it right in real time with everybody. But now in 2020, with nothing real time to watch, you know, I'm rewatching all these movies, rewatching all these TV shows, and sometimes I'd rather rewatch something than actually watch a new thing, which I think maybe is a personality flaw of mine. What is it about rewatching?
I have the same personality flaw, and it drives my husband crazy. Like, he'll be like, do you want to start a new show? And I'll be like, what if we just rewatched Scrubs? That's what we're rewatching now. We're rewatching Scrubs. And awesome. Right, he'll be like, there's all these shows. He always wants to like come and wants to tell me about like whatever new show he was like reading about that's supposedly great. And I'm like, okay, but we've been rewatching Scrubs and I really just want to do that. I think there's something fun in, it's like equally fun to stumble upon an episode you don't remember as it is to stumble upon an episode you do remember. Like, I'm rewatching Scrubs, which I don't know as well as Sex and the City because I don't rewatch it quite as much. And it's like, sometimes an episode will start and I'll be like, ooh, it's this episode, I know. And then I get so excited. And then other times an episode will start and I'll be like, I don't remember this one. Now I can't wait to see what happens with these people. It's nice to see characters who you feel like you know really, really well. And then it's almost like they're doing something new if you like don't remember the episodes. You're like, oh yeah, I know these exact characters and I know where they're going and I know everything that's going to happen to them. But like, I don't know, it's I don't have like a great psychological, theoretical, like, reason for doing this. I just think that it's comforting and it's satisfying and it's like,
I think you're onto it. The great TV critic Molly Lambert, and by the way, if you ever rewatch Mad Men, read her Mad Men recaps. They are amazing. They're my favorite thing I've read in the 2010s. That's how good they are. She would talk about TV and say, I consider the characters my friends. And when these shows come back, you know, when you be in on Mad Men and be gone for a year as a Sopranos, whatever, and then the show comes back, you're like, okay, I got my friends back. Billions is back. I have my friends back. Yeah, I think I can see that connection between viewer and program.
Right. And for me with Sex and the City, to rewatch like all the time, there's also something about, so I watch it with, I think I talked about this on that podcast, that like I watch it with my sister. So whenever we're together, we watch it. And then sometimes we watch it when we're not together. And it does feel like it's like an excuse to be like, I'll text her and I'll be like, oh, I'm rewatching season two. She'll be like, yeah, great season. She'll be like, I'm rewatching season six. And I'll be like, yeah, that was good. The end sucks. I mean, you know, it's the same way that like, it's like, why do people quote shows that everybody knows? Because there's humor in the recognition. And if you have that with like one specific person, it feels sort of even more like, even my husband, who does not enjoy Sex and the City, has now had foisted upon him inside jokes about Sex and the City because of how many times I like quote lines or whatever. And so, right. It's like now it's like when, if I'm like rewatching it and there's like a, you know, a moment that we've referenced too many times, it feels funny. It's like, it almost like, I mean, I'm sure some like actual sort of human psychologist or professor at a college could like explain this to you, but it feels like it almost like triggers the same feelings as like a joke where you're like, oh, it's that line again. It's that line that I knew was going to come because I say it to you all the time. it's like, particularly now, I think it's funny that you say like characters are like friends, because it's like, that's the thing we're not doing, is we're like not seeing our friends as much. And so it is very, very nice and comforting, and it, right, it feels almost like when your friends reference an inside joke, to like see a line or hear a line that you knew was coming, you're like, ah, I'm comforted by the feeling of someone saying something that I like, that happens in the same exact cadence every time.
Yeah, it's familiar, like an old Afghan. It's familiar, like your aunt's cooking or something. It's just something about that familiarity. By the way, when I was looking at that podcast, I can't give the context of this, but when you guys had the joke that ended with "breathe through your nose," I almost drove off the road. I just want to, that's your little Easter egg. Your job now is to rewatch Sex and the City and find out what that joke is about. But you know, Brian Koppelman talked about the Billions showrunner, and he was one of the co-writers of Rounders. He just wanted to create a show that would be that, like a movie like Diner, which a bunch of people would quote, a bunch of people would identify with and want to rewatch and want to, and not just quote it, but when you have that quote in your arsenal and then you find the right moment where it's apropos and it just hits that target. I mean, that's really the fun of it, right?
Right. Exactly. I think, and yeah, it's like, there's not enough opportunity right now to actually experience that in real time because we're not like hanging out with our friends. And so instead, just kind of go back to the source material.
So a big part of Sex and the City, again, is, can relationships be fixed? Should you even bother trying to fix it? And we'll go back, we'll awkwardly drag this back to baseball. I get frustrated sometimes where I wish I could say, again, I love baseball and I work in baseball and, you know, I'm for baseball. But I wish I was allowed to complain about baseball without, it feels like there's a pick a lane moment where you either have to be, you know, for everything that's innovative and you're a geek who never played and you're a stat head and you're out of touch because you don't have any athletic bones in your body, or you're some old get off my lawn guy who doesn't want anything to change and wants everything to be like it was 25 years ago when it really wasn't that great. You just think it was because we're all addicted to nostalgia. I'm a little bit frustrated by how the game is smothered with home runs and strikeouts. I don't know how they really get that genie back in the bottle. What do we do about that? Can we fix it? Should we fix it? Or some people might say, hey, you know, love it or leave it.
I think we should fix it. I actually think what's interesting about what's wrong with baseball is that it's, I'm going to steal a thought from the Effectively Wild podcast, which is the smartest podcast about baseball, which came up a long time ago. Like, a year or two ago now that they were talking about this. And what's funny is they weren't even talking about baseball. They were talking about how something happened in football and they, whatever. They got on this spiel about how people love to complain when they disagree with what the head coach does in football. And these guys who cover baseball were like, relish that, because we don't do that in baseball anymore, because every move is optimized and there's no room for disagreement. And they were like, that feeling that people are making the wrong move, or that like it could go either way and you wish it had gone the other way, they were like, that's disappearing in sports. And so I actually think that what's interesting is that like what needs to happen in baseball is people need to be like thrown off their rhythm a little bit. So this is a suggestion for how to fix the game that comes from someone very high up at Major League Baseball. This is this is like, it's not Rob Manfred, I'll tell you that, because otherwise this would have already happened. But but a source of mine who's high up at the league, and people who probably know him will know this suggestion because he's not shy about it. But he's said that the solution is to move the mound back, that like, we just kind of have to disrupt the actual mechanics of baseball ever so slightly, so that way people kind of have to relearn them. That like, it's almost like the pitchers have gotten too good, and because pitchers have gotten too good, that's forced batters to try to optimize home runs instead of trying to get hits, and like, and that there's almost this like, and that's really what it is. It's like we have too many home runs and strikeouts because everybody's realized that it's, you know, not worth it to try to get a hit, because getting a hit's too hard, and then getting three hits in a row is virtually impossible. So you're never going to score if a guy just gets a single. You might as well just try to get a home run, and if not, strike out and start again next inning. And so, right, it's like, it's almost what needs to happen. It's like the sort of muscle memory needs to be disrupted. The ball needs to, I don't know, be bigger, smaller, rounder. Less, it's like, I actually think that that's the thing. It's like, I don't actually know that there's a rule change, a specific rule change that we can make, because the rule changes that are designed to sort of incentivize different styles of play are never actually going to address the fact that, like, well, someone, I mean, this is a vast oversimplification, but like, someone will just, you know, plug that rule change into whatever algorithm they're using to tell you what to do in any given situation. And then they'll just always follow that. Like, it's like the idea that you can incentivize small ball, I understand it, but it's probably always going to be imperfect. Either that, or my suggestion, which was my humble proposal in the first ever episode of Bandwagon, which is just like, move the fences back, make the fields way bigger, make them way bigger, make it way too hard to hit a home run. So that way people are no longer incentivized to put the ball in the air, and they're forced to try to, you know, hit into the gap and all that. I say that, and I think it sounds like a perfect solution, but I'm sure that what would actually happen is like scoring would just go way down.
Yeah, I'm afraid it probably would. Although what I might time, well, first of all, there's so much good stuff in there to unpack. One of the problems with optimization is it isn't what is optimal is not always aesthetically pleasing. You know, we've right. seen that in the NBA, right? They figured out that the 3-point shot is what you do. You spread the floor, you get guys who can shoot. And yeah, you know, when you watch the Warriors of a couple of years ago, when they had all these great players, it was fun to watch. But, you know, watching a lot of teams play the same way can get boring. The Houston Rockets have a thing where James Harden has kind of figured out the pick and roll and how to cheat, you know, his way into fouls and stuff like that, how to kind of break the game in a way that if you're not a Rockets fan, you might find aesthetically hard to watch. I look at, and this is where people jump on me and say that I'm, you know, get off my lawn, I'm too old, stop talking. I don't mind teams being smart with their defense, but I would like it to be a limit to what you can actually do on defense with shifting. And the reason why is because when David Ortiz would ground out to a keg party in right field, that's not satisfying to me, you know, and I get it. Look, they know where he hits the ball, and look, Ortiz hasn't adjusted. He's not bunting. He's not trying to hit the ball to left field. He's just pulling the ball into the shift, hoping he'll rip a double or hit a ball over the wall. So I get why the defense is doing what they do, but I would still rather that be a hit if a more traditional defense was in place. I wonder if they could just say, look, you're going to have two people on either side of the infield, and you can't leave the infield skin. Well, yeah, that would lead to a lot of those outs would be hits now, and I'd say, well, what's wrong with that?
Yeah, I'm with you. That's one of the rules that I would embrace, but that's because I grew up in the Ryan Howard era in Philly, and extremely sympathetic to people whose careers were cut short because they couldn't learn how to hit against the shift. I am for this again. I guess this makes me like one of those old get off my lawn people, and not the opposite. But like, yeah, I'm sort of for rule changes that are designed to preserve the game as opposed to designed to disrupt the game. Like, I think I understand that's a guy goes, I guess, against the move the mound back. But it's like, I don't want I think you'll want to talk about this. I saw this on your rundown. Nothing makes me angrier than the runner on second base in extra innings. This is like a hard line stance that I have, but that feels like an
ad. That's a gimmick, right? That feels like a gimmick.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. It feels like they're sort of saying, like, well, you know, unfortunately we can't make these extra innings exciting. And it's like, if you can't make extra innings exciting, then you're doing something wrong holistically, because extra innings are the most exciting innings.
Like, that's the good stuff. And you know what? If a pitcher, if a position player has to pitch, that's fun too. I mean, the way we communally share, they're in the 17th inning in St. Louis. Make sure you're watching this, or stay, when some West Coast game ends at some crazy hour of the night because the Padres and Giants couldn't score a run. That's the good stuff.
Exactly. Right. I think it's sort of like, it's correcting the wrong problem. If the problem is the game is becoming too homogenous, there's too much downtime between pitches, there's too many late inning pitching changes, whatever, that's not being corrected by kind of rushing through the weird stuff at the end. Like, let the weird stuff be weird, because that's what actually sort of breaks up this other homogeny. And putting a runner on second base in extra innings is not addressing the fact that, innings 5 through 9 are boring in a blowout because they're still taking too long between every pitch. Like, it's not actually sort of addressing what's driving people away. And instead, it's trying to limit the game time. It's misunderstanding the problem, which is pace of play and not length of game.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't have a problem with the extra inning game that takes a long time. I have a problem with an 8-1 game that takes 4 hours and 27 minutes.
Exactly. Right. And it's almost frustratingly out of touch with what people are annoyed by to suggest that. And right. It's like, and here's the, if, and my sort of last, my death knell point for the runner on second base is like, that's not going to make extra innings more exciting. That's just going to make everybody swing for like a sacrifice fly. And I don't want to, like, that just means every game is going to end on a sac fly. No game is going to end on a home run, because it's not worth it to hit a home run. And the only time home runs are exciting are in extra innings.
Yeah. Oh, did you see last night when the Phillies won with a bunt and a fly ball to shallow left field? With the guy who made a bad throw and he scored. Yeah, boy, that was great. I can't wait to rewatch that over and over again on Twitter.
There will literally be no extra inning walk-off homers if you start with a guy on second base, because it's like the most optimal way to win is bunt him over. Bunts don't even make sense, but they do if the guy's starting on second base. If you have a guy on second base and no outs and you only need one run, then suddenly it makes sense to just like move the runner over as opposed to swing for the fences.
Do you think this is something people go back and forth on? Do you think if players were more eager to bunt or hit the other way, that the shift would just have to go back to something more traditional?
I do wonder. I'm sure someone has looked into this, and possibly they've even written about it. And I invite you to share this with me. But like, I do wonder, for guys who are so good at baseball that they play at a major league level, how much harder could it be to add into your arsenal hitting against the shift? Like, that just, it does feel like I'm like, look, man, I can't hit a baseball at all. But if you're Ryan Howard and you can hit a baseball, how come you can't learn to hit it the other way? That feels like that. Just take an entire offseason, my man, and just focus on that.
Right. Couldn't any tennis player, if like half the tennis court was unguarded, couldn't any tennis player find a way to hit the ball over there? I don't know. I know that's apples and oranges. And the thing with bunting, too, is if you radically shift to somebody and give them the whole side of the field, your bunt no longer has to be exactly good. It just has to be anywhere in that field of play, and you're going to walk to first base, and that has value, because then maybe the next guy hits a home run and it's a 2-run home run.
No, I'm completely with you. I would love, when the pandemic is over and the labor unrest and we're back to playing baseball and it's a normal season, if someone hasn't done this story yet, I'll look into it. I mean, I also always wondered, and now it's going to go away because we're going to get the universal DH. I did always wonder, like, wouldn't it behoove NL pitchers to get a little better at hitting? Like, how many, if every NL hitter put in an extra hour and a half of work every week in the batting cages, how much of a difference would that make?
Again, it's going back to thinking about baseball when I was 11. I used to wonder, like, wait a minute, I play Little League and the best player in the field is always the pitcher. He's out, and he plays shortstop when he's not pitching, and he bats third or he bats fourth and he hits a million home runs. And these guys go to the major leagues and you're telling me they can't hit anymore? I mean, that has to be that they've decided to discard the skill. It's not worth it to them to maintain it. I get why the universal DH is coming. And look, it'll open up another job and, maybe we'll add more offense. I guess it kind of has to. And I'm not going to miss pitchers having horrible bunt attempts and striking out on a foul third strike. I'm not going to miss that. But I did like this goes back to optimization and everybody playing the same way. I think sports are best when there's different styles of play. You know, they say like styles make golf tournaments, styles make horse races, styles make prize fights. And I think sports are more interesting. Like in football, a lot of teams play the same way. But then you had like the Tennessee Titans last year and said, no, we're going to run the ball like it's 1978 and we're going to throw the ball 20 times a game and try to beat you that way. And I say, you know what? Good. If you can do that, it's more interesting. That the Ravens with their offense with Lamar Jackson, totally different than what most teams do. They're a unicorn, but that's fun. I like unicorns. And along those lines, I kind of like that the American League and National League had two distinctly different styles of play. Why not keep that?
Absolutely. 100%. When people like, I hate the DH, but mostly what I hate is I hate the universal DH. I love that they had different rules. I love that it was weird and different and that it actually meant something to be in one league or the other. Like that it felt like also sort of a very naturally evolved quirk of the game, which mm-hmm. I appreciate. And I like, right. I liked that there was even like a cultural sense that you were like my sister. I was just talking to my sister. We're from Philly and she's finishing up an English PhD and her husband is looking at jobs or whatever. They might move to DC. And I was like, oh, DC, that'd be an interesting city. And she was like, yeah, I mean, at least it's a National League city. Like, you know, right. Like I like the idea that if you are a fan of NL baseball, that affects your sort of entire baseball culture, that only NL baseball is real baseball. Like, I think I don't want them to be the same. I want them to be a little weird and a little different. And I want there to be this debate between which way is better or realer, you know.
Right. That's good. Right. Even a little bit of antagonism is good, you know?
Right.
I'm not saying the guy should have bench clearing brawls, but I like that. When I was growing up, the American League couldn't win the All-Star game. And again, 11-year-old me wanted the American League to win so badly, you know? And I think we're going to lose some of that. I don't mind the interleague play. If you're going to have 15 teams in each league, because it was stupid when we had a division with four teams and a division with six teams. That didn't make any sense. They had to go, you know, three sets of five and embrace interleague play constantly. I accept that. But I think we're missing something. If we give up, I think the DH, I think they're fixing a problem that really doesn't exist. And, you know, every once in a while I'll hear somebody say, like, I've never understood this. Somebody will say, well, we need more standardization with the ballparks. Like, are you crazy? Every ballpark should be totally different than every other ballpark.
Every ballpark should be totally different. Before everything happened and this got completely derailed, I was trying to do a story this spring training, asking people around baseball, what's the most extreme ballpark to team construction matchup that you could dream up hypothetically? Like if you could wave a wand and change your ballpark, how would you want to change it so that way you could optimize your team to fit it and sort of have the biggest home field advantage? Which is part of what I would have to do this story is make that pitch a little pithier. I like the idea that story would go away completely is kind of sad.
No, totally agree. By the way, speaking of pithy, I come back to Sex and the City. Thank you for that podcast. I've had the end credit theme in my head all day. And just, you know, that show, just so it's just like a cookie cuteness to that show. It's such a writer's show. It's funny that you have panache in your, was it your Instagram or one of your social media accounts?
Yeah.
Because I wrote down some notes about Sex and the City and I just put, you know, swankiness, panache, wittiness. I mean, that's just such a writer's show. You know, that show is just trying to show you, look how smart and deft we are.
That's what I like. For sure. Sorry, I'm like trying to also look at, there's apparently baseball news happening. So
by then, hopefully, you know, this is a mad celebration and you can delete all the stuff on this show where we talked about how ugly things are right now. I'm going to ask you one Sex and the City question, then we're going to get to our condiment draft. In 30 seconds, is Carrie Bradshaw a Karen?
Oh, yeah, totally. In the sense that she is a privileged white woman who centers herself and can only see things through the lens of her own problems. But that's what the show is about. It's about how everyone thinks their problems are the biggest problems in the world, even when they're quite clearly not.
Well, it's so funny you say that, because I was trying to figure out today, why is it that I liked her character? Or at least I wasn't bothered by her character. I wasn't like violently against her character, but the lead character in Girls I could not stand.
I mean, I think it's because, oof, I could be wrong here. I think it's because Carrie is an id. She's like a Karen-y id in a way that like is sort of a guilty pleasure indulgence to imagine, like, what if I ignored all the real problems in the world and allowed myself to be completely obsessed with my own sort of interpersonal relationship drama, which is a more satisfying vehicle for selfishness and for sort of, you know, a female anti-hero who is an anti-hero because she's so self-centered, than the version in Girls, which is someone who is constantly sort of running up against the real problems of the world. And like, the, I think the main character in Girls, Hannah Horvath, is actually in some ways a little bit more self-aware, and that makes her more frustrating. Like, they let Carrie just be completely unself-aware, and if someone, it's like, you know, what if the only thing in the world was your relationship problems? And people are like, man, sometimes I do feel that way after a date. Whereas the Hannah Horvath character is a person who exists in the actual real world but chooses to be selfish, and that feels more frustrating.
Maybe also you talked about the idea of shows earning things that they go on to later with plot arcs. And maybe I just feel that Carrie Bradshaw's angst has more earnedness to it that maybe Hannah's problems don't have.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's I think it's honestly just like a flaw in the writing. Like, I think part of what makes Sex and the City a successful show is that they were able to balance something that feels sort of pathosy with something that's quite clearly not. It is quite clearly sort of self-indulgent, shallow, escapist, but it feels deep on an interpersonal level. Whereas, and I think that that's like a very carefully threaded needle, or at least in my, and this is like, you know, obviously the show has like deep flaws as it relates to sort of race and sexuality, and is like very much a product of its time in the way it talks about like social movements. But I think the reason, like literally the reason people like it, is because it's escapism, where the escapism isn't just the clothes and it isn't just the real estate. The escapism is like talking about yourself all the time. I don't know. And I think the flaw in Girls is that they actually thought that it was a deeper show than it was. And so that makes it feel less deep.
And again, I come back to Sex and the City. It's not even to me, it's so much what they say, it's how they say it sometimes. It's just, it's such a witty, clever show, and such a writerly show. And that's why I liked it. You're only allowed a one word answer, and I'll accept nobody as an answer. Carrie should have ended up with who?
Carrie should have ended up with Aiden.
Yeah, that's my answer too. Yeah. We're going to transition to our draft, and because we've meandered all over the places I was hoping we would, this has been a delightful conversation. We're going to go speed round. We're drafting condiments. I'm up against somebody with a food writing history, so I'm going to get crushed in this draft. There's also some nuances to, you know, what actually is a condiment, and what, you know, what's legal, what's not legal here. Whatever. These are supposed to be silly. Hannah, you're up first in our five-round condiment draft.
Mayonnaise.
Wow. Mayonnaise. I had mayonnaise as like a, you know, maybe a free agent. Mayonnaise would not go in the, you know, maybe, you know, the Dodgers would give it a tender, it a invite to spring training. Pitch me mayonnaise in 10 seconds.
The idea that mayonnaise is controversial is completely overblown. Everybody eats mayonnaise all the time. It's in a bunch of your favorite sauces. You could put it on everything. I also think it's the thing that you would really, really deeply, deeply miss if you didn't have it. I think that it's tempting to say that that's ketchup. Ketchup is a little sort of just like lowbrow for my tastes. I think anything that you would put ketchup on, you can put mayonnaise on it, man, and it would taste great. You put just mayo on a burger, that's a delicious burger.
Well, I'll admit, I'm with you that ketchup is like the all overrated team of condiments, and I'm going to try not to draft ketchup. I'm going to go actually with mustard, which is the underserved. Mustard, so there's so many kinds of mustard I like. I like classic mustard. I like honey mustard. I like Dijon mustard. I like Mean Mr. Mustard. I like Colonel Mustard. I just like the way the word sounds. I like where mustard comes from. And for all these years when I thought I liked hot dogs, they were really just a proxy for me to have mustard.
I'm jealous of your mustard. I'm glad I would have taken it if you hadn't. But instead, I'm going to take my number two, hot sauce. Can't do without hot sauce. You need a hot sauce. At some point, you're going to need a hot sauce. And a hot sauce is like, that is a flavor profile, to reference the Salmon Norset book. salt, fat, heat, acid. I don't know if that's the order that they're listed in, but heat is a literal, that is like a, so here's the thing. I'm taking fat with mayo and I'm taking heat with hot sauce. Like a lot of foods benefit from just having a little bit of heat.
Yeah. I mean, the great thing I can say about hot sauce is a lot of times I probably shouldn't eat it and it doesn't agree with my stomach and I eat it anyway, just because of what it adds to the food. So that's it's a very viable pick. I know some people might look down on ranch. I'm sorry. I like ranch. I think anything is good in ranch. You put ranch on. I mean, I will even occasionally dip a steak in ranch. I think it's that good. So I'm unapologetically pro ranch.
All right. My number three, even though you haven't taken it, I don't think you're going to, so I could wait, but I'm going to go just to give it the respect it deserves. My third pick is pesto. Oh, pesto. I love pesto. I make pesto. My family makes pesto. I grew up, my dad made pesto every single week to the degree that we never even emptied our pesto Tupperware. We just continuously refilled it. And you may think pesto, that's just a pasta sauce. That's not even a condiment. Wrong. If you have pesto in the house, you will use it as a condiment. You will put it on bread. You'll put it on sandwiches. You'll dip in it. Pesto is an underappreciated condiment.
Yeah, you know, when I was driving my girlfriend to work today, we were talking about this. I try to do these things organically, these drafts, because they're just silly anyway. But she's like, oh, you have to have pesto on your list.
Oh, and God, I said, well, I got it.
I bet I could sneak it in like the fifth round. I don't need to prioritize it. But I was, you know, showing I don't understand the condiment market. I have exposed my ignorance here. I'm going to pick, screw it. I'm going to pick Thousand Island, whatever that is. Whatever they put on Big Macs, it's just good. It really makes a burger. I don't know that they call it special sauce. I think it's just Thousand Island dressing. It's a really, really great addition to any hamburger or any piece of meat, really.
I did. I asked Yahoo Sports MLB editor Zach Kreiser what he would pick, and he was like, "What's that like sauce they put on burgers? Like that?" And I think you're right. I think I disregarded it because we didn't sort of know what it was. But I think you got the sneak star in Thousand Island dressing, because I wish I had taken it. All right, I'm gonna go for my fourth pick, soy sauce, because you need it for a whole genre of cuisines. I don't want sushi without soy sauce. I don't want fried rice without soy sauce. I gotta have soy sauce on my roster in case I'm eating anything Asian.
Yeah, absolutely. Man, there's so many great condiments with Asian food. One thing I really miss, we almost did a draft of things that we miss, and I really miss eating out in restaurants. And
oh my God, so you know, much.
That's the first thing I'm going to do is get Chinese food when this whole thing, you know, hopefully we get back to life. I don't know when that'll be. Maybe 2 years for all we know. But in the fourth round, I'm going to take, I could have taken this first round. I love horseradish sauce.
Oh, now, very smart.
There are different versions of it. Some restaurants will have it. It's not as good. Some brands are better than others. So you kind of know the good horseradish when you have it. And if it's not that great, like I go to a local deli that has horseradish, but it's not that great. I'd rather use the horseradish I have at home. But and I don't like to smother things with horseradish. You really got to spot it. It's like a knockout Josh Hader reliever. You can't get 250 innings from horseradish, but I'm a big horseradish fan.
All right. So this is my last pick.
Make it count.
And I'm taking this one to sort of for variety on my team. This feels like I had the other four listed. I could show you, but I won't. I had the other four listed and I had my fifth spot open so I could sort of react to what you did. And after seeing some picks that you took that I'm jealous of, I'm making my fifth and final pick, tzatziki. Tzatziki, I'd love a creamy, like I need something a little creamy, a little herbaceous on my team. And I'm taking some tzatziki sauce. I've been buying tzatziki. My husband and I are like staunch everything has to be homemade people, and so we never buy anything. And one of the like treats that we are allowing ourselves during this quarantine pandemic time is like store-bought tzatziki, because it really does, like it's like a nice, if you're feeling lazy, you could put it on like an egg sandwich or like put it on leftovers and it makes them taste good. So that's my team.
Yeah, that's an interesting, I'll admit I don't know anything about that sauce at all.
Oh, tzatziki. It's a Greek sauce.
Good. You're saying things that sound interesting to me. Like, I'll say that. So,
you know. What is that? Like scallions? Not. Tzatziki is, it's a Greek sauce with cucumbers and garlic. It's like, or with like yogurt. It's like a creamy yogurty sauce with like some lemon in it, some garlic. It's a nice, like, it's one of those things you could totally make it at home. It's like not worth buying in the store, but if you do buy it in the store, you'll be like, I'm going to put some tzatziki on this. But everything.
You got me sold. You say creamy and garlic, and I immediately just put the check mark on it. You know, I love like a garlic aioli sauce. I love a remoulade sauce. You know, I probably should take Remoulade here, but I promised my girlfriend I would take Sriracha. I don't know. She doesn't realize this draft has nothing to do with what I will buy at the grocery store, but I'm not even saying it right, but we have a lot of it in our fridge. So I'm going to take one for the home team and make that our fifth pick in our condiment draft. Drafting with Hannah Kaiser, great baseball writer, food writer, woman of the world. I hope we gave you some optimism here in kind of a dark time for baseball. And this was fun. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for joining us today.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me. I'm going to go figure out what's happening in baseball.
Appreciate that. Tell everybody how they can keep up with you.
Okay. You can follow me on Twitter at Hannah R. Kaiser, K-E-Y-S-E-R. You can follow me on Instagram, but you don't have to. Clever with Panache, but it's like a double C-L-E-V-E-R-W-P-A-N-A-C-H-E. I should switch that to my real name at some point.
Yeah, you're posting all the outfits from Sex and the City, or that's a different account?
That's a different account. You should also follow every outfit on Sex and the City. It's a fantastic account. I love them.
There you go. Good stuff. Well, for Hannah, our lovely guest today, and for our producer, Raghu, in the City of Angels, keeping us good sounding on the air, I'm Scott Pianowski. Let's keep the good thought for baseball. Everybody be safe, and we will talk to you next week.
I'm Mike Lizikoff, Chief Investigative Correspondent for Yahoo News.
And I'm Dan Kleidman, Editor-in-Chief of Yahoo News.
We're the hosts of Skullduggery, where our current focus is on the president and his administration's handling of the coronavirus, as well as the 2020 elections. Subscribe and download Skullduggery wherever you listen to your podcasts.